Consumers are spending more,
but we're earning less.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiatakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. Happy Friday. It's September 30th.
Coming up, the banks adjust to new regulations, and that means we consumers will have to adjust to new fees.
Massachusetts makes a big change in its alimony laws.
I'll talk with the former governor of Michigan about what the nation can learn from that state's experience on jobs.
And using Twitter as a mood ring.
Those stories and more just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference. Conference calls that give you clarity, professionalism, and flexibility all at a low price. For two Vast Conference calls free with no commitment, go to vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
There's word this morning from the government that people spent slightly more money in August, 0.2% more, but income, what people make, fell for the first time in nearly 2 years. Let's get a little analysis on all that. Jill Schlesinger is editor-at-large at CBS MoneyWatch, and she's with us from New York, as she is every Friday morning. Morning, Jill.
Good morning.
Why are we making less money?
Well, it's actually a longer-term trend. You may be surprised to even know that, but really since the 60s till today, real disposable income has been slowing. Of course, since the recession, conditions really deteriorated further. That's because companies were reducing all the hiring and their hours, and that was an effort to make more money in whatever way they could.
Now, one company, Jill, is trying to make more money. It was announced today, Bank of America is going to start charging its debit card users $5 a month starting next year. I mean, we know they want to make money, but what's really behind this?
Well, no one ever confused banking with the Red Cross. So, yes, they do want to make money. But this is actually a direct reaction to credit card reform. Banks really kind of threatened us during that whole process. They said, well, you know, government, if you reduce the amount of money we make in swipe fees, we're going to have to make that up someplace else. And evidently, banks are going right to the heart of the matter. They're going to debit cards. Banks were actually about to lose $6.6 billion in lost revenue from those swipe fees. So I'm not surprised that they came at this, and they came at it hard.
And some other banks have done this as well, to be sure.
Absolutely. I think this is going to be a trend. Banking is going to cost more for all of us. And I think that that is something we have to just take in and say, all right, we know it. Let's make sure we know what we're paying for.
The future of banking. All right. Jill Schlesinger from CBS MoneyWatch joining us live from New York. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
Have a great weekend, too.
Well, as the banks adjust to the new rules that are part of the financial reform law, our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale tells us there will be a lot of changes for consumers.
Bank of America just tacked a $5 fee on debit card accounts. Wells Fargo, SunTrust, and Chase are among the banks trimming their debit card rewards, and others are charging for a printed monthly statement.
Free checking as we know it is becoming harder and harder to find.
Bill Hartikoff heads the consumer credit website LowCards.com. He says consumers will be buffeted between banks raising fees on debit cards and merchants offering incentives to use them over credit cards.
You will see the retailers suggesting when you reach into your wallet, hey, is that a debit card you're using? Just punch in your PIN number right there.
Banks say stores may not pass on their windfall, but Matt Arnold, a retail analyst with Edward Jones, says competition will take care of that.
All it takes is one retailer to lower their price and pass through the lower swipe fee, and the others are pretty much forced to follow suit.
Pretty soon, stores could be offering discounts or even faster checkout lines for debit card users. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Manufacturing in China is slowing down, according to a report from HSBC Holdings. Concern about a slower Chinese economy is one reason for a recent drop in Chinese high-tech stocks. Another reason is a report that the Justice Department is looking into possible fraud at Chinese tech companies listed right here in the United States. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports that's likely to help deflate what's become a Chinese tech bubble.
The bubble began losing its buoyancy earlier this year. That's when dozens of Chinese tech companies listed publicly in the U.S. admitted their auditors were resigning over bookkeeping irregularities. Michael Clendenin is managing director of Red Tech Advisors in Shanghai.
I think in general, this has made the Justice Department quite nervous, and it's certainly the SEC is even more nervous about how these companies that are listing in the U.S. but are outside of U.S. jurisdiction, what kind of accountability do these companies have to, you know, the markets that they're actually listed in, and are they frauds?
To find out, investigators are expected to take a close look at reverse mergers. It's when a Chinese company sells itself to a much smaller U.S. firm that's already publicly listed. That minimizes scrutiny from U.S. regulators. Now, with this new investigation, that scrutiny will intensify as federal prosecutors pore over the financials. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmidt for Marketplace.
This week, Massachusetts decided that alimony is no longer till death do us part. The state is abolishing lifetime spousal support after divorce in most cases. Kurt Nickisch reports now from WBUR in Boston.
$45,000 a year. That's how much Steve Hittner was paying his ex-wife for life.
Divorce in Massachusetts, you've hit the lottery.
To make the payments, his second wife had to get a second job. It didn't make sense to him.
The idea of alimony for life was born of another age when women didn't work.
Hittner's case prompted the state legislature to reform the system. Short marriages here no longer require long payouts. Most alimony ceases at retirement now, and it also stops cold when the ex-spouse moves in with a new partner. Maria Cognetti is with the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. She says other states are also rethinking alimony.
The economy's forced us to look at how we apply the law.
Cognetti says being out of work makes it harder for exes to pay up, and that's been exposing cases where the system could be more fair. Florida and Tennessee have already made changes. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Ousted Hewlett-Packard CEO Leo Apotheker leaves HP with $13 million in cash and stock. I guess that was his golden
parachute. It's a pretty good deal, yeah.
Apotheker was in command for less than a year, while the company's market value dropped by $40
billion. I must say, Steve, that that the idea of a CEO like Apotheker leaving HP with a big chunk of change, there is an argument to be made that they have really given him a big black mark on his resume. It's going to be very hard for him, I think, to go out and get another CEO job.
So he'll need that $13 million
going
forward.
You know, if that's the end of his career,
he's going to be out of work for a long time, although he could probably, you know, I don't know, bag groceries at Piggly Wiggly.
Probably wouldn't be hard to come up with a reason why he shouldn't get it. But anyway, we play both sides of the fence here on the Midday Update.
Absolutely.
Which is online at marketplace.org. We are also on Twitter. I am at Jeremy Hobson.
And I am at Radio Chio.
And the show is at Marketplace. Place Radio.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Vast Conference, the service that gives clarity, professionalism, and flexibility for conference calls at a low price. Vast provides both regular and toll-free numbers so you can set up calls anytime and provides web tools to manage or record calls instantly. Priced at 2.5 cents per minute with no commitments or contracts, try Vast Conference with 2 free calls at vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace. That's vastconference.com, promo code Marketplace.
Well, now to the number one issue in America, jobs. Jobs, jobs, jobs,
jobs.
We talk a lot about it. Experts have been scratching their heads, trying to figure out how to get people back to work, and our next guest has a few ideas.
She is Democrat Jennifer Granholm, who just wrapped up 2 terms as governor of Michigan in January. She was governor during the collapse and rebirth of the American auto industry, and she's just written a book about her experience called A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. She's with us now here in Los Angeles. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I want to start with a moment early on in your governorship. The Michigan economy is starting to get worse, and this big company, Electrolux, decides to move one of its factories down to Mexico. And what do you do?
We went to Electrolux, and they're in a very tiny town of 8,000, but they employ 2,700 people. We had to keep it. It would have been like a nuclear bomb going off. So we said, we're going to put everything we have on the table, including tax-free 20 years, including helping to build them a new factory. The workers offered huge concessions, the local community as well. And they said to us, there's nothing you can do.
There's nothing you can do.
There's nothing you can do.
And you hear that over and over again from company after company as the economy starts to get worse.
Right. And the point being that it was all about this global economy. They Electrolux could pay $1.57 an hour in Juarez, Mexico. Other companies were trying to be competitive by going to China. They were getting pressured to lower the price of their products. And so what has happened in Michigan really is like a canary in the coal mine. It's what's happening across the country, not just in manufacturing, but in other sectors too. And the whole point of this book is that the world has changed, and therefore our strategies to create jobs in America have to change too.
Is there really nothing we can do, or do you think that there is something that should be done structurally to make our employees and our locations here in this country more attractive to companies?
There's absolutely something we can do, but the point being that states alone are not equipped to compete against countries like Mexico or China or Germany. It's got to be a partnership with the federal government, states, as well as the private sector. We've got to copy what other countries are doing who are very aggressively competing in a global marketplace, places like Singapore, which have a very aggressive, comprehensive national economic strategy. They are not hands-off, which is what a lot of people who are saying get government out of the way. If government has hands-off on this, then we will continue to see the loss of jobs.
Do you think the federal government is doing now what needs to be done?
Partially. I think what the president has done is to tie tax policy and the Jobs Act to job creation in America. And I think that's very smart. Every bit of policy has to have the question, will this create jobs in the United States, or will this somehow provide extra capital for a company to invest somewhere else? Companies are in it to maximize the shareholder return. That's their fiduciary responsibility. If they have extra capital or extra cash through tax cuts or whatever, if they're unspecific, they're going to invest that extra money where they can maximize their return. That will be somewhere else, somewhere other than America. So we've got to be very specific about tying it to the United States.
Another interesting point in your book is you go out and you try to get foreign car makers to do more business in Michigan, and your constituents aren't happy about that.
Well, because we had for a long time feared the globe. And, you know, we had been in a position of seeing jobs go somewhere else. And I kept saying to people, you guys, we cannot be victims of the globe. We have to take advantage of it. And our nation has to do that, too. Every other country that's aggressively in the game to create jobs for their citizens has foreign direct investment goals. We should have that, too, as a nation. Every ambassador in every country should be required to get a certain number of companies from that country to come and invest, create jobs in the United States, and hire Americans. This whole strategy, I mean, one of the Jobs Act that the president has put out has public sector investment, which is great. You're creating American jobs for construction workers and teachers, et cetera. But the real issue is, how do you create private sector American jobs? And really, that partnership is necessary. Here's what Singapore does. They say, we are going to provide you with access to capital. We are going to condense the permitting times. We've done an assessment of our economy, and we are going to provide you with customers. We're going to provide you with a cluster of businesses that will make you competitive, that we're going to get foreign direct investment of companies that dovetail with your strategic interests. They have a strategy. We don't have a strategy.
Is the Michigan that you left prepared to do these kinds of things? Are they doing them already?
We started that, but it has got to be a long-term comprehensive strategy. Let me just tell you a quick story. In my terms as governor, I cut more out of government, the footprint of government, than any state in the country. We cut more government employees than any state in the country because of the contraction in our economy. Our corporate tax burden dropped more than any state in the country, and yet we still had the highest unemployment rate. The point being that those strategies, which are often the strategies supply-siders would have us adopt, did not work. What did work was when we were able to partner with the federal government to invest in strategic sectors that we knew we could be competitive in. For example, the battery for the electric vehicle, saving the auto industry. Those kinds of strategies, which are smart, strategic, active government, not big government, active government, are what worked.
Do you think that the picture has been painted adequately for the American people of what the U.S. economy would look like if we had not bailed out the auto industry?
No, I think that people have often, not everybody, but there's a lot of people who think, one, that government shouldn't be involved in picking winners and losers, and therefore we shouldn't have strategically intervened. But if you hadn't strategically intervened, we would have lost the backbone of the American manufacturing industry. It's not just the car industry, but it's everything that feeds into it. There are 10,000 parts plus to every vehicle. And what are those parts? Steel, tire, rubber, glass, electronics, you name it. All of that feeds into the most technologically advanced mass-produced product in the world, which is the American automobile. So you would lose that, and the international companies who build cars here would also be losing their suppliers. Our unemployment rate in Michigan would have been over 20%, but throughout states that have these suppliers, it would have been significantly impactful. And what do we do as a nation if we don't make anything? We will lose as a nation. We are a weak nation if we don't have the means to manufacture.
How big of a role do you see manufacturing playing in America's future?
I think that advanced manufacturing absolutely must play a role in our future. It's a critical national need for a country to be able to build stuff. If we don't build things, then we are basically, you know, cutting each other's hair and teaching each other how to paint. That is not going to be a way that a nation is strong. So advanced manufacturing, the robotics, the technology associated with an advanced assembly line, the U.S. could and should focus on those issues, and especially manufacturing the means to make us energy independent, for example. We should be making that stuff here.
But can we get back up to a point where a quarter of our population is working in manufacturing?
Not in the repetitive motion, low-skill manufacturing jobs, but advanced manufacturing, absolutely. I wouldn't say a quarter of our population, but certainly when you think about the infrastructure associated with sophisticated manufacturing, you have to have a high-skilled population, all those engineers, et cetera. When you lose the backbone of manufacturing, when you lose a manufacturing plant, you also lose the research and the development and the engineers that go with it, because the engineers have to be near where something comes off a production line. So it's not just the actual building, but it's the brains that go into that building that you lose as well.
You mentioned President Obama's jobs plan, which really doesn't look like it's going anywhere.
Because he has got people in Congress who will not compromise one penny. He has proposed things in this jobs plan that Republicans have proposed in the past. And the fact that they're saying no, the fact that Republicans, when asked, would you take a deal of cutting $10 for every $1 in revenue, all of them say no, shows that you're not dealing rationally, pragmatically. He has demonstrated that he's the adult in the room and he's willing to compromise. They are not. I think now he's taken a different posture, saying, you need to give me people I can work with in this next election.
Is there anything that you see that would lead you to believe that we are going to get to a situation in the next few years where Washington is willing to really work together?
I think it's up to the people. They hire members of Congress, and if they're not working, they should fire them. If you're hiring people who refuse to compromise one dime when America is in the middle of this crisis, then I think you should fire the person who is refusing to compromise.
Is there anything you think President Obama should be doing differently?
Well, I think that what he's doing right now, I mean, I think he had to do what he did up to this point, which is to demonstrate that he was willing to compromise, that he was ultimately extremely reasonable. But once it became very clear that not one penny of compromise would occur, and we'll see what happens with this deficit commission that has been the super committee that's mm-hmm. been assigned the responsibility of cutting and compromising. But if that shows that there's no ability to compromise, then him coming out, taking off the gloves, coming out swinging, and encouraging the citizens to take democracy and give us people who will work to compromise and be pragmatic, then that's the only solution he has.
One of the things that's been happening in Detroit to deal with the housing crisis is that they're actually tearing down homes, get some inventory off the market. Do you think that needs to happen nationwide?
Well, I think that I can speak to Detroit. Obviously, there's been a huge loss of population. Obviously, so much of what has happened with the contraction in the auto industry being responsible for that. If you have vacant houses sitting there, it becomes the target for blight, clearly, and you know, drug dealing, crime comes into the neighborhood. Getting rid of them is good. Then you've got to figure out how to concentrate your population in areas. Detroit has got swaths of neighborhood blocks that don't have any homes or that have homes that are on slated to be torn down. What do you do with all that open space? So interestingly enough, I mean, Detroit has taken on urban farming as one way of doing that, which is, I think, a very interesting strategy.
Okay, finally, a quick lightning round now.
Uh-oh.
What kind of car do you drive?
Volt. A Volt, which is made in America. The battery, the guts of it, made in America, all made in Michigan.
And as we always hear, more car than electric, they say, right?
Well, more car than electric, meaning that it's not a tin can. This is a substantial vehicle. But hey, can I just tell you quickly, I know this is a lightning round, but this Volt that we drive, we are in a house that is powered by solar panels. My electric bill last month was $4.95. I plug in the car.
Wow.
It's powered by the sun. I never have to spend money on gasoline. All I do is plug it in at night.
So you have a very low carbon footprint. Which of the car makers has done the best job in adjusting to the new reality in Detroit?
Oh, I think they're all doing it. Honestly, I can't pick a favorite. Obviously, Ford didn't have to go the route, but because they were visionary a couple of years earlier and had gone to the market to actually borrow. Bottom line is all three have seen an entirely new day. It is a new paradigm in Detroit, and I hope that people consider buying products that are made in America.
Okay, this one I'm actually going to make you pick. Which is the biggest threat to our economy right now? Housing, unemployment, American debt, European debt, or other?
Jobs. It's all jobs. I mean, unemployment is the issue. If we have jobs, then we will reduce the size of our debt. Clearly, though, the globalization of the economy, which, of course, is impacted in Europe, demonstrates that the world has changed and our strategies have to be cognizant of the fact that we're dealing with economic competitors who are very aggressive.
Jennifer Granholm, former governor of Michigan and author of A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. Thanks so much for coming in.
You bet. Thank you.
50 years ago this month, Congress wrote the first check for the Peace Corps, mandating that it, quote, promote world peace and friendship. And now, as part of our special podcast exclusive series of interviews, we ask, where does the Peace Corps stand today? And is it worth the cost in these pretty tough economic times?
Leah Conan is a contributor for the Fiscal Times, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, make the case, first of all. What do we get out of the Peace Corps?
I think most importantly right now, we have a huge unemployment crisis among young college grads. So the unemployment is now 15% among 20 to 24-year-olds. And studies have shown that every year out of the workforce diminishes your lifetime earnings by about 2 to 3%.
But wouldn't some people make the case that maybe instead of putting people in the Peace Corps and sending them off to other countries, that we ought to be employing them making bridges and roads here in the United States?
And that's a very good point. And I think, you know, AmeriCorps does work towards, you know, the U.S. infrastructure and helping the U.S. But I think the Peace Corps is still a wonderful program because not only is it getting these graduates, giving them something to do for 2 years, but it's also giving them a chance to see the world because student debt is now reaching $1 trillion. Many of these young people can't just go to Europe or go abroad like their parents might have after college. So I think this is a great way for them to kind of help the world and see the world at the same time.
I'm curious, Leah, are more people getting into the Peace Corps because jobs are scarce or perhaps they can't do it? They can't afford to take a few years off because, you know, they need to enter the traditional workforce.
Actually, applications were up 18% last year for the Peace Corps, and competition is tough. So more people are interested in it. And I think many can afford it because, you know, they're provided living expenses, they're given medical insurance, they're giving a lot of benefits, and they can also defer their student loans.
So it's like a job.
Yes.
The toughest job you'll ever love, right?
Yes.
How does it pay off, Leah, economically in those countries and also here at home?
You know, most importantly, if you look at what these volunteers are doing, 14% of them are working in business development in different countries. So, for example, a volunteer in Senegal, he worked with artisans who were already making these beautiful baskets, and he worked with them to get them U.S. distributors. So that's bringing money to the local economy that otherwise wouldn't be there, but it's working off what they're already doing. And then I think, you know, if you look at similar programs like AmeriCorps, for example, research has shown that for every dollar invested in these types of service programs, we get $2 worth of essential services in disaster relief and education and things like that. So what I found while researching this article for the Fiscal Times was that these type of programs are actually saving the government money.
Leah Conan is a contributor for the Fiscal Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
There's a big football game tomorrow. Jeremy, you like football, don't you?
Not as much as you do, Steve. Yeah,
well, okay. There are lots of games tomorrow. A lot of big games.
I'll be watching. I'm a basketball person.
I know you are. Talk about it. The NBA.
If it starts, yeah.
Yeah, you never know. But big games tomorrow. I'll be watching Alabama, Florida, my Crimson Tide. I'm looking forward to that. Roll Tide, absolutely. Thank you. And also Air Force plays Navy. And it comes at a time when both of those teams could be preparing to join the Big East Conference to replace Pitt and Syracuse, which are leaving next year. Sally Herships now looks at what Big East membership could mean for both of those teams.
When it comes to football, the Navy has always been an independent. The Air Force is part of the Mountain West Conference, but financially, they're in similar situations.
Typically, any football program outside of the Big Six football conferences don't make money.
Victor Matheson teaches sports economics at the College of the Holy Cross. He says joining a premier conference translates into millions in television revenue. Dr. Harvey Schiller is former commissioner of the Southeastern Conference. He says the greater exposure has a number of benefits, but
they also have to be careful that they don't line up every Saturday against the Big Ten.
Like Ohio State or Michigan. Schiller says the military academies impose weight restrictions to keep their students fit for the battlefield. That doesn't help on the football field. No matter where Navy and Air Force land, they may have trouble recruiting. Many prospects are gunning for a stint in the NFL, not the armed forces. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
There's a big financial bloggers conference starting up in Chicago today.
And our own personal finance wizard, Marketplace Money host Tess Vigeland, is headed to the Windy City to check that conference out. And she's with us now with a bit of a preview. Morning, Tess.
Good morning, Steve.
So financial blogs are pretty much everywhere now.
They are. And you know what we're really talking about here specifically is personal finance blogs. And there's a pretty wide range of what you'll find. You have lots of blogs dedicated to frugal tips.
Yeah.
Wise Bread, probably one of the most well-known. But there are hundreds like Frugal Dad, Frugal Girl, Frugal Law Student, and it goes on and on.
I'm sensing a trend there.
Yes. And then you also have the ones where people who are usually anonymous will open up their financial lives for everybody to see. What you spend, what you make, and hopefully that kind of keeps you on the straight and narrow. And my open wallet is one of those.
And all these people are going to be in Chicago meeting.
They are.
Wow. What are these folks going to be talking about?
Well, I think for a lot of them, the sessions are about helping them make some money off their efforts.
Yeah.
There are thousands of personal finance blogs out there, and you need to figure out how to make yours stand out. One of the sessions is called Getting to a Million Page Views on a Small Budget. So it's really about helping them boost traffic.
How do we know whether to trust some of these people? I mean, anyone can go on the web.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, at this point, a lot of them have been around long enough that they've got a track record, like most of the ones I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But I did notice this week that Wise Bread put together a really great list of top personal finance blogs. So you can check that out. We'll have a link to that on our website.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you know, lots of them are just basically telling their stories. There's no science to it. You need to be a smart consumer, figure out, you know, if a blog you've landed on is somehow scamming you. But for the most part, this is just folks saying, here, this is what works for me.
Take it with a grain of salt.
Always.
All right. Well, enjoy the time in Chicago, and we look to hear the program when you come back.
I'm looking forward to the Red Hots.
All right. Tess Vigeland, host of Marketplace Money. Tess, thanks.
Thanks, Steve.
And finally this morning, researchers at Cornell University say there really is a late afternoon slump. You know, now, Jeremy, you and I don't work the typical 8 to 5 shift, right?
Right.
But so many people, and I remember when I did work that shift, you'd get like really kind of woozy or tired.
Yeah, 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
O'clock, yeah, you're just ready. You're just
when
ready
I was
for
actually
bed.
In the New York Bureau of Marketplace, I would go out. I would never have coffee in the morning, but at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I would always walk down to the Starbucks and get a cup of coffee.
You got to get the second wind going, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, you need look no further than Twitter to really examine this afternoon slump. According to thousands of global tweets, the day starts off with words such as happy and excited. So people are tweeting, they're all happy and they just woke up and they're writing all kinds of great stuff. And as time goes on through the day, those tweets start to use words such as sad and panic, depressing. In the study, those researchers also found, by the way, and I thought this was very interesting, happy hour, Jeremy, typically means after 4 p.m. on Monday through Thursday, but after lunch on Friday. So keep that
in
mind.
That's interesting. So yes. Twitter tells us when the early weekend begins.
And off to the bar we go.
That's right. In Los Angeles, yeah, for us, it actually starts around, what, 7 a.m.?
Absolutely.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Have a great weekend. I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.